After the terror charge was laid, co-chair of the Uluru Statement, Pat Anderson, released a statement, and she said that the attack and the sluggish, inert response of elected leaders is a stark reminder of how Aboriginal people are viewed and treated in this country. Mm. The message that hurt her the most was that of silence. The silence was overwhelming, she said, and she added that Indigenous people live in a reality knowing that it's never been the government's priority to keep them safe. Mm. She says that the voice to Parliament, had it been enshrined, would have spoken up. Do you think that moments like this now show the importance of a representative body like The Voice, or what it might have been able to do?
Absolutely. I agree with that. I think I said in the piece that I wrote for The Guardian that a voice to Parliament would be able to take carriage of this work for the government, you know, in helping to push forward on awareness of what anti-racism work looks like and what work we all need to do, individuals and institutions, to make lasting change in this country. First Nations people notice that there are envoys to Parliament advising them on how to respond to race hate in the community. And, you know, it's well past time that they listen to First Nations people about the race hate that we experience. You know, this was an Invasion Day gathering, the one day of the year we all dread, because it's the day that Australia celebrates the start of genocide. So every year we peacefully gather our families together, kids, old folks, you know, people in wheelchairs, you name it. We all come together because it's the day for our community to get together and offer support to each other, show that we love each other. And it becomes that kind of, it's the energy that gets you through the rest of the year. Mm. So for someone to throw a bomb, whether it went off or not is irrelevant, but it strikes at the heart of what it means to be a First Nations person in this country. Mm. Our people face racism, the interpersonal and the structural kind, every day. The statistics are there for everyone to see. There's discrimination in education, housing, health, the justice system, you name it. Deaths in custody have never been as bad. They're the worst on record. Our kids are being taken from our families at alarming rates. Our social markers are going backwards if you look at the latest Closing the Gap statistics. So if this terror charge that's been laid, it might have taken 9 days, but it's very welcomed. But it doesn't resolve the fact that people are now terrified. And it is long past time for governments to step in and do something about it.
I want to ask you about that, Lorena, because what happened at that Invasion Day rally hasn't spurred the same kind of policy and political debate that other comparable incidents have. Many want the government to take action against racism and violence that Indigenous people, Indigenous communities face. What could or should that action involve?
Well, the organisers of the Perth rally released a statement last week that's, you know, welcomed the charges, welcomed the opportunity that they had to speak to the police and to the Premier, but called for the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion to be expanded, its terms of reference to include all forms of violence and discrimination, because clearly, in their view, here's an example of how our social cohesion is extremely fragile for lots of Australians, not just Jewish and Muslim Australians. And they also called for a greater awareness of our colonial history and a focus on truth-telling. There were also calls, which I think are extremely important, for dedicated services to help Aboriginal people, counselling services, so Aboriginal people can, you know, talk to somebody about their fears and anxieties. You know, things that have only gotten worse since the failed referendum, but certainly worse since Invasion Day or January 26th this year.
As you've just noted, there have been renewed calls for the federal government to establish a national truth-telling process or a federal truth and justice commission. Your piece for The Guardian this week spoke about denial. Does that sit at the heart of all this?
Mm. Yeah, it does. Denial is something that's a personal psychological response to things that are troubling that you don't want to face, but it's also an institutional response to troubling recognition about hypocrisy in our society. So yeah, I think denial is very prevalent. It's very much a part of this story.
So how might a Truth and Justice Commission help?
Well, I have some views about truth commissions and their effectiveness broadly. But yes, of course, a truth commission or truth commissions are really important as sort of a civic education process. They're extremely helpful because they provide, as in the same way that this upcoming Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion will do, is put those issues on the public agenda day after day and create public discourse and public awareness. So in that sense, truth commissions are really important and they provide that civic education role. But truth seeking, genuine truth seeking and telling has to be accompanied by listening to have any impact. So a truth commission can't, in my view, be a closed door thing. It has to be very public. It is a public facing and a little bit of a performative process. So I think we need to be realistic about what truth commissions can actually achieve. If we go into them understanding that they are an educative process, that's great. But they don't bring justice. They can be a place where people can speak their truth and be heard, but justice is an entirely different process. But I also happen to think that interpersonal truth-telling is also really important and powerful and in some ways more meaningful for people who are trying to make sense of what happened in the past in the places where they live. I think it was Amanda Nettelbeck, the historian, who talked about how the violence of the frontier was very intimate. While people were killing indiscriminately, they often knew, the perpetrators often knew their victims and lived in close proximity to them. Because it was so intimate and interpersonal, I think the truth-telling needs to be intimate and personal as well. You know, there's that old saying, all the truth and as much justice as possible. I think that's very relevant in this case. I don't think there's any political institution, least of all the nation state of Australia, who can be entrusted with rationing the truth about its own history. And, you know, people will say, oh, look, there's no justice that can be administered or justice can't prevail for the atrocities that have happened. And to a certain extent, that is true. But I'm reminded of what the historian Michael Ignatieff said, which is that the choice is not between truth and justice. It is between the amount of past injustice that is and is not tolerable. It's about what we as a nation can live with and what we as a nation can come to an agreed understanding as the truth of our history. And until we do that, incidents like this will just keep happening.
Lorena Allam, we really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Noor.
That was Lorena Allam from the Jumbana Institute for Indigenous Education and Research at the University of Technology. And we've linked to her latest opinion piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Miles Herbert. Sound design and mixing by Daniel Simo. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget, you can subscribe or follow Full Story and you can also leave us a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.